Our next speaker is a provincial entomologist from British Columbia Ministry of Agriculture based in Abbotsford. Her work focuses on biology and pest management of established and invasive insect species that impact BC agriculture. This includes insect identification, outreach extension, activities, policy and regulation, development, and some surveillance. The ministry works closely with other organizations with similar mandates and goals. Please help me welcome Tracy Heppelizer. Did I say that right?
Oh, you must have been practicing there, Donnie. Well, you did a great job. Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm happy to be here to talk about armyworms and share some of our experiences from British Columbia. And I'll share a little bit about distribution, biology, and monitoring and management considerations. So we'll start just with a quick life cycle shot. This insect is in the family Noctuidae, which includes all cutworms and armyworms and some loopers. It's a huge family of insects. There's thousands of them worldwide and several hundred species in North America. This one, true armyworm, is a North American species. A characteristic of all these insects in this family is they have that delta shape adult. Usually it's a dull colored night flying moth. And I remember growing up in the prairies and they used to call them millers. Well, that's the same family. So the eggs come after the moths, and then you have the crop feeding larva, and that's your target life stage when you're managing. And then the pupa is the resting stage, and then the cycle repeats. So global distribution of true armyworm, you can see all the yellow spots there. Those are places where people have taken pictures of the moths. So you can see it's sort of spread across a temperate zone as well as a little bit in the Middle East and Central America. This is a shot of just North America, and you can see all those blue dots show where people have photographed this moth. So it's pretty much everywhere, but mostly around the outsides and even through the Canadian prairies. So I looked in the BC museums to see if I could find records of this species in BC, because this was the first outbreak that I've ever experienced, and that it seems like the current farmers have no recollection of ever seeing this before. I think that was a similar experience to some folks down here. So what I found when I looked in the museum specimens is that way back in 1903, if you look at the very top there, 1903, there's a specimen in one of our museums. And then there are catches or specimens for many years all the way to the present time. There's a few gaps, but that's probably a function of no collectors out there rather than the fact that the moth isn't there. So yeah, it is in BC. So if we organize these by month, you can see at the very top, I guess I do have a pointer. At the very top, you see May 10th, and at the very bottom, November 17th. And so people were catching moths all the way through from May to November during that six-month period. So all these samples were actually from southwestern BC, and this is a picture of Vancouver Island, southern Vancouver Island, central Courtney area down south, and a little bit on the mainland. And that's actually where we saw the huge outbreak this year as well. So there's the international border. So Washington is on the south side, and they experienced similar outbreak situation. So where are the problems this year? Of course, up there, I just said, BC, Washington, here, and also in Northern California, the rice growers are experiencing an outbreak as well. So the crops we grow in southwest BC as well as in Washington, North Washington, is grass and hay, grass, hay, and corn, mostly for animal feed, dairy, some pasture, and very little grain, very little annual cropping. So we have forage corn. The grass is a mix of orchard grass and tall fescue. They cut that hay 2 to 5 times a year, depending on the location. And we do grow some winter cover crops as well. And reed canary grass is a dominant wild species that grows in all the ditches. So what do we know about true armyworm? We know that the larva won't survive prolonged freezing conditions. However, moths can survive, and the other life stages can survive at zero for quite a while. The optimal temperature is between 10 and 29 degrees Celsius, or 50 to 80 degrees Fahrenheit, so the mid-20s are really the sweet spot for this species. It does not diapause, so that means it will keep feeding and growing and cycling as long as the conditions warrant. It is native, and outbreaks occur anywhere from 5 to 20 years, and so that's a good catch-all amount of time, makes it really difficult to predict. It seems to be associated with rainfall and weather influences, so mild winters, cool, wet springs, and the outbreaks can last about 2 to 3 years, and that's sort of a general statement for noctuids. Then what tends to happen is the natural beneficials and the weather shifts, these things kind of bring the population down. So how did the armyworms get here? Well, we're still theorizing about that, but there's some ideas that we need to keep working on, and we don't have all the answers yet. But is there a resident population that has exploded for some reason? Or did the moths blow in from the south? Did they come in on the winds and the weather in the spring and those storms that we had? So if they did come up, they would have come from California or the Gulf states or maybe Mexico. Or is it a combination? And so part of what I'm trying to do in collaboration with folks in Oregon and California is to answer these questions, because we don't know at this point. So let's look more closely at some of the life stages. This is the adult, and it is pretty dull, boring looking moth, but it does have these really cool little white specks, which you can actually see quite easily if you see this moth in the field, and that's a defining characteristic. It also does have kind of a grayish body and gray underwings, which is a little bit unique compared to some of the other species out there. Now these moths can live for a couple of weeks or longer, and they'll be laying eggs every day, hundreds of eggs every day. The moths do choose lush green areas. Their larvae survive best in those areas, and they do target those for egg laying. So basically, if it's a good condition for growing grass, it's going to be a great condition for growing armyworms. Armyworm eggs will be laid on grass heads, but this is actually a picture of the blades, and the moth will lay her eggs kind of in between a couple of blades of grass, and she'll kind of hide them in there, and they'll be fairly well protected. They're about 1 millimeter diameter globes, and there's the little larva coming out of the egg. So they feed as small, sort of nondescript, pretty cryptic larva for a few weeks. You can see they're quite a light color there, and if you can look really carefully, you can see some just hiding along the blades of the grass there. So they are kind of hard to see when they're small. So they'll feed for about 3 weeks or so, depending on temperature, and then you get this. And these are probably the ones that you're more familiar with, these giant ones that are eating everything. So there's some really distinct characteristics, which I'll show you, because there are other species you might see out there. But the distinctive head capsule, they have the netting on the head as well as the inverted V, and they have some lines on their back, but lots of them have lines on their back. What I look for is on the legs there. You can see these black markings on the fleshy prolegs, and that's pretty distinctive. So as these caterpillars get large, over an inch long, like I've just showed you, they eat over 90% of the feed that they're going to eat over their whole life in the last 2 weeks before pupation. And that's when they do all the damage to the crop. And that's why they look like they come out of nowhere. They've been there all along. It's just that you just don't notice them until they get really big and hungry. So I wanted to show this picture from Nicole, which shows the pre-pupal stage. And they sort of look like larvae, but you can tell they're starting to change. And they become lighter colored and inactive. And then they turn into the pupa. So I want to tell you a story about this bucket of pupa. So I went to visit a farm, and The guy had parked his tractor, and he moved his tractor, and then he picked about 50 pupa from his tire track. So it just shows the density that they'll put their pupa down. They don't mind being close to their neighbors, but they also don't go very deep with their pupa, only 1 or 2 inches. So that, they stay in that stage for 1 or 2 weeks, and this pupa, it looks the same as every other noctuid moth, so you can't tell it what species it is from the pupa. And there they are, resting near the surface, so they're pretty easy to find if you go looking for them. So let's talk about damage for a second, what we experienced in BC. Damage was extensive on Vancouver Island only in the hay crops in June and July. That region is drier. They didn't experience the huge rains that we did on the mainland, and it really, their crops were really hit hard. This is the kind of thing that they saw. You can see the blades of grass have munch marks in them, and that's a great thing to look for when you're scouting for larvae. And you can see pretty much the grass is almost killed in the shady areas along the bushes. The picture on the left is supposed to be a lush green hayfield, but it's totally been decimated by the worms. And this is just a picture of the baler and the worms on there. So that was July. So August 29th, I got my first call from a Fraser Valley grower in the Abbotsford area. That's about an hour east of Vancouver. Now the Fraser Valley, we did not see any damage or detect the worms at all in the first generation. And I think it's because that we had such a huge moist spring. In March, we had double the normal rainfall, and in April, 50% above normal. So there was lots of lush growth out there for them to hide in. This is what I saw on August 29th. So if you can look down here, you can see some little, that's barnyard grass in the cornfield, and it doesn't have any leaves. And then the worms started going up the corn and into the cobs as well. So we ended up with some pretty skinny looking cornfields, and growers were spraying those big fields, those big tall plants, believe it or not. So the second generation was worse. More larvae, more damage, more widely dispersed corn and grass, and it was very dry by that time. And so the managed fields were the only place that it was green and lush, and the only place that those larvae really wanted to go. Okay, now for some good news. The biocontrol agents. There are many predators, parasites, and diseases of armyworms out there. A lot of them are generalists, so they'll go on other species as well. And the bios can cause significant reduction in the populations, and they keep the populations in check in non-outbreak years. However, they can't prevent outbreaks, and they do take the edge off the outbreaks after a year or two, and some of them will actually cause the populations to crash, and that's mostly with things like virus or other pathogens that get into the populations. And usually these multiple agents work together. So I'll just draw your attention to a couple of good Canadian references. You might have seen them, the field crop and forage pests and their biocontrols or their natural enemies, and the other one is cutworm pests of the Canadian prairies. There's some good stories in there and some good biology information for you as well. So they refer to some really positive stories about how the bios have taken down the cutworms, and just one I'll draw your attention to is the 32% true armyworm in Tennessee, so, or 32% parasitism in this one outbreak situation. So that's a major contributing factor, but what I think is really cool is the 21% parasitism of the black cutworm, and then you add on the mortality from the pathogen. So that's when you start to see some action with these beneficials. So we did see some beneficials in British Columbia. This one was a pupal parasite, and I show it beside the moth and a pupa because it's really big. It's a huge moth, or a huge wasp. And we saw about 10 to 15% in the pupal collections that we did. So that was kind of good news. We also saw tachinid flies. There's the egg on the larva, And when we were digging for pupa of the cutworm, we would also find the pupa and the, if you look across the bottom there, the pupa and the larva of the fly. So that was good news. Of course, there's lots of carabid beetles out there, ground beetles, and it's hard to gauge how much impact they have, but certainly they are voracious predators of all kinds of things that they can catch. So the big question right now is, will the true armyworm overwinter in British Columbia? Well, we know they overwinter in the Gulf States and Texas. We know they overwinter in Tennessee, probably Missouri and Kentucky. Yes, to Northern California, not in Quebec, and probably not in Southern Ontario. So what about here? So I looked at the low and high temperatures in the coldest month in all these areas. Let's see, where's my pointer? So just low, high. So you can see there's the top, that's the high, low, and then somewhere in the middle is the mean. And zero or freezing is along here. And then anything below zero you can see in blue as well. So there's Quebec and Ontario. We don't have to worry, they can't overwinter there. But yes, they can overwinter in Portugal and Texas. Tennessee, yes, and note with the Tennessee, that blue, those blue lines go below freezing, so there is a bit of cold weather there, which they seem to survive. Here's all the middle ground. We're not, you know, there's, the jury is a bit out. Northern California, Pacific Northwest. So you can see that our low temperature really doesn't go to zero most of the time. So there's a good possibility based on this that it's going to overwinter. How might they overwinter? They overwinter possibly as larvae, and there's records of that from Tennessee, or pupa. So throughout 2017, we did learn a lot about the biology of this thing and what we might anticipate for 2018. And so we did have pheromone traps up in the summer, and we did catch moths, as well as in the fall. And I actually am still catching moths now in my pheromone traps in Abbotsford. We did the pupil collections, and that was pretty revealing as far as bios and when pupa might be out there. So that showed us a lot. And so I created this little timeline, and there's a lot of information on there, but what we found out is, yeah, May 29th, someone reported to me that they did find a moth in Port Alberni, so that was my top left there. Can't make this thing point. There we go. And then you can see we've got two generations, and then over here, I'm still looking. I'm going to be watching all winter to see what happens with the moths and the larva. If we look at the timeline under here, we can see that our window for sprays would have been mid-June to mid-July based on when larvae were present, and then mid-August to mid-September for the second generation when larvae are present. And I put this bar for scouting basically from May to October because I think it's important to be out in your fields, and that's how you're going to know where you are on this continuum as far as actions. So here's a link, farmwest.com. I put all my armyworm stuff up there last year, and I'll do that again in 2018. It's a good place to go for all kinds of information. So let's talk about tips on scouting, because this is going to be really important in 2018. So we're going to consider the biology a little bit. These bugs, these larvae like to be out come sunset, so later in the day is a better time to scout. Check the weak areas and areas where you've seen damage before, and walk a transect or some sort of W shape through the field so you can get a look at what's going on everywhere. Check the fields 1 to 2 times per week during peak times. I know 2 times might be a bit of a stretch, but things can move really fast if you start getting caterpillars. So, and count larvae at least 5 areas in the field. So if you think about your W or your transect, and then you stop at spots and do your counts. So field scouting, you can also scout for moths in the fields. And how we do this is by moth walk. So you walk through the field and you kind of kick the grass and you'll disturb the moths and they'll fly up. And so you can count the ones that you see flying up and then you'll have some data about moth flight. And then check the porch lights, check the walls on the barn, because they will be attracted to the lights and they'll roost in those areas. So you'll be able to find them there. And so when you know the moths are flying, you know the larva is going to come after that, and that's when you're going to want to watch for damage or watch for the possibility of damage and plan your program, your spray program. Record what you see, really important. I know you think you're going to remember it always, but you don't. You got to write it down. And then it's a great record for you to go back to in the following years. So date, time, field, number of larvae, pupa, moths, whatever you see. And as well, it's handy to write down your weather or temperature if it's pouring rain or whatever. And watch for the birds. The birds will tell you where the insects are. And that was a really useful tool for the growers in the second generation, particularly in the grass, because you can see where all the birds are. It doesn't work so well with corn. So the threshold, 4 to 5 larvae per square foot. If you see that number of larvae, you can expect damage. Okay, so what do? You do nothing, that's possible, or you plan to cut and or spray. If you're near harvest, you want to cut first and spray later. If you're not near harvest and you can still spray, do that then to prevent further damage. And you might need a second spray 5 to 7 days later, but it'll be dependent on scouting. So make sure you get in there, do a post-treatment assessment so you know if you need to go in again. The other thing that scouting will reveal is maybe you only have worms in part of the field. And maybe you only need to spray part of it. And this is a nice photo of from the coal that shows that the worms only went in so far. Insecticides, coverage is really important. You have got to get the spray down into the crowns and down around the base of the plant. So high water volumes, get your droplet size, you know, relatively coarse so that you can make sure you get the coverage in there. The goal is quick knockdown and cessation of feeding. And all the products on your list work well. There are some things to consider with each of them. So you have group 5 spinosins and 28 diamides. These have the best tox profile. They're least toxic to the non-target organisms. But insects do need to be actively feeding for these products to work the best. They do kill by ingestion, so you need to make sure that you apply it when the bugs are out there or when the caterpillars are out and active. You have lots of group 3 pyrethroids. During the hot temperatures, they are less effective. So over 26 degrees, 80 Fahrenheit, choose a different product if you can. Group 1s, the organophosphates and carbamates, they're, of course, the oldest and the highest toxicity product, but they work really well in high temperatures. So there's your list from your guide. You can see you've got a bit of everything here. So you have lots of good choices. This is interesting, this besiege, group 3 and 28 together, and then spinosad. The other thing I want to mention is, just be aware of your REIs. We had some luck with Bacillus thuringiensis. Usually for noctuids, for these big larvae, I would not suggest, well, I definitely wouldn't suggest this for commercial operations, but if you have caterpillars around your yard or around your building site and you don't want to use a synthetic insecticide, the BT has some efficacy and people were using it in their backyards and killing caterpillars. The insects have to eat it to be effective, but it's just one option. So I think there's a new update in your handbook, so you should have a look at that. And I guess that's it. I'll stop there. Yeah.
So for the freezing temperatures, how much freezing temperatures do we need? Like a couple mornings of frost, or does the soil have to get low freezing, or kind of what helps the knock down those overwintering?
The number I'm thinking of is about -6 degrees Celsius. So that's I don't know what that is, 20. Cold. It's pretty cold. And for how long does it have to be that cold? I would say it would have to be a good 24 hours. So, yeah, it has to be pretty cold. Yeah. Yeah, based on what I heard from the meteorologist yesterday, I agree. I think that we need to be ready in 2018 for another go-around with this thing. The impact on the bios, I can't really answer that question. I don't know what the wet spring will do to them. And maybe by spring I'll know the answer, but I can't answer it right now. I anticipate that the armyworm will... Well, they'll be in the wild spaces too, and they'll be overwintering probably in hot spots and wild spaces where there's been limited management. And if that's the case, then there should be a good collection of bios building up in there along with them. But if they're overwintering in the field where you've been treating and managing, there'll be less bios in that environment. So I expect it to be a bit variable. All right, well, I'll be around here for the rest of the session, and if you have any questions, feel free to contact me. Thanks.